Well, good morning. Great to have you here this morning. I'm a little bit under the weather, so there'll be no hugs or handshakes at the door, kind of maybe just an occasional fist pump or an elbow if you're a Canucks fan or something like that. But I thought it was all better, and then Friday afternoon came back to haunt me. But I'm excited to launch back into Joshua here. We looked at Joshua chapter 1, and we're going to look at Joshua chapter 2. And Joshua chapter 2 is a very intriguing story, eh? You kind of wonder why it's in the Bible. And it's a story of an outsider who becomes an insider. And we've even got that happening a little bit in our society now with this wedding that's coming up in May. And, you know, the engagement was last month. How many royal followers are there? Okay, a few people, yeah. So Prince Harry and Meghan Markle are getting married. And like I said, it's a little bit of a story of an outsider because the British press is already starting to poke into it. And there's some questions now, like how long is the marriage going to last? And how long can she put up with this machine? You know, the British tabloids and that sort of thing, as they started to poke fun at her and to say things like, she's not one of us. She's an outsider. She's from across the pond, from America. Or it almost seems like now the Canadian media is trying to own her, right? Say, oh, she's Canadian. She's got a house in Toronto or something like that. So, you know, and they've said things like, she's divorced, you know. Or she's not royal material, some have proclaimed. Or they said, her mother wears sweats. Evidently, that's not fitting for a family of royalty. Or they've sunk so low to reach into her ethnicity, and they said, she's half African American. How tragic when people sink to that low. But to say that, all in all, she's not one of us. She's not like us. And the story in Joshua chapter 2 is like that. But we see that God declares someone and embraces someone who was an outsider to be an insider. So Joshua chapter 2, I invite you to turn there or turn on your mobile device. And let me start reading. Now Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim. Go over the land, he said, especially Jericho. So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there. What's up with that? Joshua chapter 1 that we looked at last week was that the strong and courageous chapter. You know, go into the land. This is the promised land that I have declared for you. I've decreed that it's yours. I'm going to be with you. These are the promises I'm making to you. And so we're expecting in Joshua chapter 2 that the Israelites are going to cross the Jordan and begin to claim this land that's theirs. Instead, we get this spy mission and the spies end up at the house of this prostitute. Like, how'd they end up there? Why'd they end up there? Now, some people, to make themselves feel better, point out that the Hebrew word for prostitute also means innkeeper. And there's been some Jewish historians that have written about that. But the problem we have when we come to the New Testament writers reinforce that she's a prostitute. I put a couple of those verses on your outline there. James 2:25 and Hebrews 11:31 talk about her in that way. So here these spies are staying at Rahab's inn. And how did they find that inn? We really don't know. Because again, they're spies. They're trying to stay undercover. There's some speculation that back in the day, you know, similar to we've got a red light district now in Amsterdam, that there was a red rope district back there, back in that day and age when the red rope would be hung in her window. We don't really know. But we know the spies enter the house, and we find out they're not really good spies. Take a look at the next verse. The king of Jericho was told, look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy out the land. So the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab. Bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they have come to spy out the whole land. That kind of happens in the Jason Bourne movies, right? You know, Jason's in a house somewhere or in a building. And sure enough, they barge in. Now, again, we don't know how the Jericho Police Department, or the JBD, as I got in my notes here, how they found out about the spies being here. But not, unlike in the Bourne movies, they don't smash the door down. They come and knock. And they come and talk through the door. And you're like, what's up with that? Why would they do that? And the only thing I can conclude is, this is kind of, you know, ancient Near Eastern hospitality rules that apply, that you never go barging into someone's house, even when there are spies there and the king has sent you as part of the police department. So they go to the door, they knock on the door. Look at the woman's response, verse 4. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. She said, yes, the men came to me, but I didn't know where they had come from. At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, they left. I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You may catch up with them. But she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax she had laid out on the roof. So the men set out in pursuit of the spies on the road that lead to the fords of the Jordan. As soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut. Now, she's committed an incredible risk here in hiding these spies, right? She's guilty of treason. She's going to be killed if she's found out. But amazingly, the JBT, they trust her. They trust her word when she says, hey, go to the ford of the Jordan River. Maybe you'll catch up with them. I'm not sure why they would trust her. Perhaps she's well known in Jericho. I'm speculating here, but maybe she's also a temple prostitute. And so they're thinking, hey, we've got no reason to not doubt this woman. She's one of us. She would be on our side. Those spies are the outsiders. You know, so they believe her word and they go chasing after her, after these guys. And it's kind of ironic, verse 7 there. And as soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut. So here are the spies from the Jericho Police Department are going out. They go outside the city wall. The gate behind them shuts because it's dusk then. That gate won't open up again till dawn. So they're going to spend the night kind of searching in the field, in the areas there, looking for these two spies that have been spotted in town. But the ironic thing is they're outside the city gates and the spies are actually inside the city gates in the home of Rahab there. Now, Rahab, she seems, not only is she a prostitute, she's also a businesswoman. She's got flax up on her roof there. Flax was used to make clothing. Perhaps she made clothing. Flax would need to be dried out before it'd be prepared into linen thread. Usually it was harvested in big quantities, so she's probably got a big quantity of flax up on her roof there. So it wouldn't be that difficult to hide the spies in that. Rahab's life is a mess. It was a mess before the spies showed up. It's a mess now with the spies that she is hiding. She's got all kinds of strikes against her. First strike is she's a Canaanite and she's not a Jew. And Jericho, where she lives, is part of the Amorite nation, part of the Canaan, and it's going to be completely destroyed. It's going to be wiped out. And she is going to be part of that destruction. Her second strike is she's immoral. She's a prostitute. She's profited from deceit and from breaking up families. If indeed, like I speculated, she's a temple prostitute, she's also desecrated worship in that way. Third strike, she's dishonest. She's lied to protect the spies. She's used to lying in her profession, in a sense, lying to wives. And she seems so smooth in her lying there, eh? To the police, you know? She says, oh, you know, the men showed up here and they kind of did their business and then they took off right away. I didn't know where they're from. Go hurry on and chase after them. Her life is a mess. Some of it is her own choices. Some of it is now stuff that's happened to her. She can be killed by either the Israelites or killed by her own people for her treason. Life is a mess. And maybe you can identify with Rahab. Maybe you're feeling, my life is a mess. Maybe like her, You kind of suffered some of the consequences of some poor choices, and you feel like your life is kind of spiraling downhill. Maybe you, like her, you've kind of mixed up honesty and dishonesty. Maybe life is just throwing stuff at you. It's hitting the fan, and you feel it's a mess. Maybe your life is kind of R-rated like hers is. But there's a different R rating in the Bible. And that's the R rating that stands for redemption. And we see redemption in her life, and we can experience it also. Let's keep reading. Verse 8. Before the spies lay down for the night, she went up on the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord has given you this land, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea, for when you came out of Egypt and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted in fear and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that you will show kindness to my family because I have shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign so that you will spare the lives of my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death. Our lives for your lives, the men assured her. If you don't tell what we are doing, we will treat you kindly and faithfully when the Lord gives us this land. So the messiness of life of Rahab's life continues there. The JBT knocked on her door. She made what appeared to be a split decision in sending them off. But it's actually, we read here in that section, it's something she's thought through. Because her and her fellow Jerichoites, they've heard about Israel. They've heard what has happened. They've heard how the Israelites crossed the Red Sea. And in her words, the Lord dried up the water. She also references their two kings in verse 10, Sihon and Og. And we read about them in Numbers chapter 21. That Sihon was the king of the Amorites and Og was the king of Bashan. And we know what happened to them. Take a look at verse 10 in your Bible there. What's the last word you got in verse 10? Shout it out. Destroyed. You got destroyed in your Bible there? Now, you got in your Bible a little letter beside the word destroyed. Look down at your footnote. Or if you're using U-Version, you can press the text box that appears there beside the word destroyed. And you'll see a little meaning of the word destroyed there. You see it there? I've got in the bottom of my Bible, I'm using a paper Bible. The Hebrew term refers to the irrevocable giving over of things or persons to the Lord, often by totally destroying them. And so she's heard about these two kings and their cities and what has happened. And we will in the future, tell somebody before the service, we will actually deal with this concept. It's called harem. It appears again and again in the book of Joshua. And there's things that trouble me about the Bible. And that concept of harem really troubles me. And I've had about 25 years since I've started reading the Bible to think about it. And I will share with you in a message my thoughts about it. You may not agree with the conclusions I'm reaching on it. In fact, I don't even like there what it says in the footnote where it says, refer to things or persons giving them to the Lord. I would say giving them to a deity. But anyways, we'll save that for the sermon when I get there. Like I said, I've thought about this a lot and this concept of violence. Anyways, back to Rahab. So these two kings and their cities, they were totally destroyed. So every resident would have been killed. The Jews would have pilfered all the buildings, taken out the gold and silver. And so Rahab, and again the Jerichoites, west of the Jordan, they've heard about some of these cities who've already been destroyed east of the Jordan. And so she says twice there, a great fear has fallen on us. She testifies to God's power. I don't know if she's kind of surrendered her life to God at this point. I mean, she says in verse 11, when we heard of it, our hearts melted in fear and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is God in heaven above. I don't know if she's saying that's your God, if she's kind of, we do know she's on this journey to making Yahweh her God. And so she decides in the midst of this, of what she's hearing happening outside of her city of Jericho, she decides to side, in a sense, with the God of Yahweh. She's had two knocks on her door, right? She's had the knock that came from the two spies, and she's opened it to them. She's had the second knock of the Jericho Police Department, and she's had to decide, which does she follow? Who does she follow? And who's God? Because in Jericho, there's this polytheism of multiplicity of gods versus the theism of the Israelites. And so she's decided to hide the spies as an act of faith, a gutsy risk of faith, to follow Yahweh. And it's interesting, she begins to negotiate there with the spies. And she uses a very interesting Hebrew word there. The word is hesed. Everybody say hesed. Hesed. It's one of the most common words in the Old Testament. That it's used almost exclusively of God to describe his unconditional love. It's again and again in the book of Psalms where the psalmist says, "Oh God, I praise you for your hesed," meaning I praise you for your kindness. I praise you for a love that has no strings attached. And he or she uses that word hesed. And she said, "I have shown you hesed. I've shown you kindness. I spared your life. I could have surrendered you to the Jericho police and your lives would have been done. But because I did that, will you in return show hesed to me and my family?" And so she forms this human covenant with them. And their spies respond that, "Yes, we will do that." It's interesting. When we look to the New Testament, there's three references to Rahab in the New Testament. Two of them I put there on your outline for you. And so you see Hebrews commends her for her faith, and she's listed in the Hall of Faith there in Hebrews. And James, he writes about her and her good actions in terms of sending off the police and in terms of hiding the spies, and she's commended there. But my question is, was her lying a sin? It's wrong to lie, right? Is it wrong to lie in this situation when you're sparing somebody's life? Does that make it okay? In that case, is it all right to lie other times when you think there's a greater good that results as a result of your lying? Or is it always wrong? Is she wrong here in doing it? Is it a sin in doing it? Now, she's commended in the New Testament for her faith, not for her ethics. What about her lying? How does that fit in there? Now, we could obviously do a whole sermon on that, but that's something you may want to discuss in your discipleship groups. Rahab's faith was meager. She didn't know a lot about Yahweh, but she acted on what she did know. And in the midst of her life and the mess, she's got this flawed faith that emerges. Like Rahab, we may have made some poor choices. We may have dishonesty and honesty. We may have truth and lies in the midst of it. But when we reach up to God in sincerity, God will reach down to us and show kindness, his hesed love to us when we come to him. Let's keep reading. Verse 14. "Our lives for your lives," the men assured her. "If you don't tell what we are doing, we will treat you kindly and faithfully when the Lord gives us this land." So she let them down by a rope through the window, for the house she lived in was part of the city wall. She said to them, "Go to the hills so the pursuers will not find you. Hide yourselves there 3 days until they return, and then go on your way." Now the men had said to her, "The oath you made us swear will not be binding on us, unless when we enter the land, you have tied this scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down. And unless you have brought your father and mother, your brothers and all your family into your house, if any of them go outside your house into the street, their blood will be on their own heads. We will not be responsible. As for those who are in the house with you, their blood will be on our head if a hand is laid on them. But if you tell what we are doing, we will be released from this oath you made us swear." "Agreed," she replied, "let it be as you say." So she sent them away and they departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. So we've got here, the writer describes for us where she lives. That she lived in, verse 15, a part of the city wall. Or the Hebrew literally reads, she lived in the wall of the wall. Which is kind of problematic. And we don't really know what that means. She lived in the wall of the wall. You know, two possibilities. You know, the obvious one would be that there's this wall of Jericho. And according to Josephus, who was a historian around the time of Jesus, he said that the wall of Jericho was so thick that two chariots could ride on that wall, you know, on the top of the wall. So that wall's got to be fairly thick. Chariots might be 5 feet wide kind of thing. So that wall's going to be like 12 feet thick, you know, something like that. And so she had this house that she had built kind of on top of the wall. So that's one possibility. The other possibility that she lived in the wall of the wall was that that there's kind of this casement inside the wall. That in a sense there'd be one kind of part of the wall, and then another part of the wall, let's say again about that 12 feet thick, and then the inside of the wall, they would take stones and rocks and whatever, and they put that inside the wall, particularly in times of war, to prevent when the enemy would come with their battering ram to try and knock down that wall. And then during times of peace, they would pull out the rocks from there, and they would use it for storage or even for housing. And so homeless people or somebody like Rahab, who's on the margin of society, could live in the wall like that. You know, we don't know for certain, but it does sort of explain how on kind of one side of the wall, she in a sense can hang her little, you know, red rope district, you know, that business is open and the whole city of Jericho would know. And then on the other side of the wall, she can hang this long rope down. And again, we don't know how she got this rope, and even the way the text reads is kind of confusing there. Like the spies gave her the rope, like hang this rope. Did they have it or what? But that we're not sure again there. But that, you know, you can kind of in a sense have the rope on both sides there. And so when the Israelites come to invade, they're going to see to not destroy the people who are living in that home. And so the spies lay down kind of three conditions for her, right? The scarlet cord has to be hanging from the rope. Rahab's whole family has to be staying in her house. And secondly, that Rahab's got to keep secret this covenant agreement that they have made. And to demand kind of the legal weight for sort of this agreement, the spies invoked something that was called the blood guilt formula. And so it'd be basically that, you know, our blood for your blood, you know, if anybody breaks this covenant, you enjoy the rewards of it if you obey, you suffer the consequences if you disobey. And so, if her family is in her home when the Israelites invade Jericho, then they will be spared. And if they're not spared, then the spies say the blood is on our head. Likewise, if some of her family there, and they reference her mother and father and brothers, so I'm assuming that's the family that she's got there, doesn't have any children or a husband, even maybe that's how she ended up in this profession. Perhaps she's a widow, couldn't remarry, we don't know. And if any of her family is outside of the house, and they will get killed, then the blood is on their head because they didn't agree to the terms of the covenant. And so what ended up happening to Rahab and her family? Well, the only other reference to her in the Old Testament is a couple chapters later, Joshua chapter 6, when she's mentioned there. Verse 24, then they, the Israelites, burned the whole city and everything in it, but they put the silver and the gold and the articles of bronze and iron into the treasury of the Lord's house. But Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute with her family and all who belonged to her, because she hid the men Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho. And she lives among the Israelites to this day. How did that go for her? I was thinking about that Wednesday morning when I was reading this text and rereading again, and I was at Starbucks kind of pondering this and thinking, she lived among the Israelites? Like, how did that go over? Like, did she also receive an allocation of land? Like, she was part of the group that was to be exterminated, and here she's now an insider with them. Like, and how did the people react? They're like, what's she doing here? Like, did they question Joshua's leadership as a result of this? Like, why did you ever send those spies there? Why did they end up there? Like, did women kind of hide their sons from her? Did wives kind of glare at her? Like, you know, stay away from my husband kind of thing. Like, did she start her profession, you know, in amongst the Israelites? Like, or a new life? Like, all these things we don't know. But I do know that often it's very difficult to be an outsider amongst a group of people. And I think God's heart for her here has got to remind us to welcome the outsider. Welcome those who perhaps don't look like us or think like us or eat different than us or have different habits than us or perhaps have notorious pasts like Rahab has. Because in God's view, there is no outsider. And His arms are open wide to embrace people to be on the inside. Particularly people on the margins like her. Because think about it again in Israel. Is she going to have any female friends, you know? Given her past, she's been a marriage wrecker. She's literally lived in the wall. We need to embrace people because God embraces people. And this passage really hit me heavy on Wednesday morning as I was looking at it. I was I'm not a really emotional kind of guy, but I got quite emotional. Because it almost seemed like God was saying to me, Rick, hold up the Rahab mirror. Because sometimes I can be self-righteous. Sometimes I can be judgmental of other people. And when we hold up the Rahab mirror, it just kind of washes all that self-righteousness away, right? And we realize, but for the grace of God, there go I. And we all need that grace of God. And the story reminds us that her life was a mess, but our life is also a mess. But in the midst of that mess, the Messiah shows up. Grace shows up. As Francis Schaeffer said, and having been unfaithful to the Creator, the whole human race is a harlot. Jesus was called a friend of tax collectors and sinners. He hung out with the Rahabs in His day. And all through history, God invites those who are misfits, those who don't fit in, those who are on the margins, those whose lives are full of shame and guilt, to come to Him. He's the all-inclusive God with arms who are wide open, it says, I love you this much. Come be part of my family. You're a trophy of my amazing grace. Like I said, three times she's listed in the New Testament, Rahab. The third time she's listed is in the genealogy of Jesus. And it's interesting there, Matthew, who is a guy well acquainted with shame, a guy well acquainted with being an outsider, because he worked as a tax collector, taxing his fellow citizens for the hated Roman Empire. He knew what rejection was all about. When he lists her in the genealogy, he doesn't call her Rahab the harlot. He doesn't call her Rahab the prostitute. He calls her Rahab. That's who she is. So God sees her. And God's not ashamed to have a prostitute in His family line. God's not ashamed of you. Entitled this message, You Can't Spell Messiah without mess. My life is a mess. Your life is a mess. And we sometimes ask ourselves the same question that Rahab asked in verse 12 there. I think I got it on the screen. Why don't we stick it on the screen there? The question that she asks there in verse 12. She says, give me a sure sign. She says to those spies, give me a sure sign. We've made this covenant now. Give me a sure sign. And we ask that same question of God too, don't we? Give me a sure sign. I want to know, God. Is this real? Are you going to accept me? Or is religion right? Religion that says the good deeds versus the bad deeds when I come to my life. Is that how it turns out? God, give me a sure sign. What if all this stuff about Bible, Jesus, Christianity, what if it's all made up? Give me a sure sign. God, what if? What if I fail you? What if I make choices that are so bad? What if I keep just stumbling, God? Give me a sure sign that you're going to accept me. Give me a sure sign that you're going to embrace me at the end of the age. Give me a sure sign that I'm righteous in your sight. And God, friends, has given us a sure sign. Because he said, your sin, which was represented by that little red string that you got when you came in. Your sin, my sin. Your transgression, my transgression. Your failure, my failure. Your shame, my shame. All of our shortcomings, he's taken and he's placed them upon his son, Jesus Christ. And he said, your sin for my innocent life. And so he invites you to come to the cross with your scarlet cord. Come with all your brokenness and you will find acceptance. Come with all your shame and sin and God will come with his amazing forgiveness. Come with all of your life. And if God can show up at a brothel in Joshua chapter 2, he can show up in your home. He can show up in your life. He can show up in your heart. Come to the cross. We say, give me a sure sign. And God says, this is the sure sign that I give you. My son's blood spilled on your behalf. When the early church read this story in Joshua chapter 2, they read the atonement into this passage. And they saw God's atoning grace. And so we come. If you've been accused, God sets you free and embraces you. If you've been criticized and castigated, God will welcome you. If you've been defeated and depleted, God will embrace you into his family. And so, friends, let's reflect upon this incredible grace of God. That little string that you got. Feel its texture. Consider your life. Consider your sin. But don't stop there. Don't stop under the condemnation. Because it's easy to end there. That's what the enemy would have us to do. But as the Apostle Paul writes in Romans chapter 5, where sin abounds, then grace abounds even more. That is, we go to the communion stations this morning. I invite you to consider your own life, your own sin, but then consider his abundant grace in the midst of that. So elders, I'll ask that you will go to one of our stations. Our elders were on the prayer team today, and they'll be at the communion station.